All right, welcome to the first section for E259. So this is meant to be very casual and really meant to be a Q&A opportunity, meant to be an opportunity for me to go into more detail on how the code works or where you should look for projects, and just generally be more of a resource so that you don't feel subsequent to lectures that you're kind of on your own altogether for the projects and so forth. I do think, again, that there's a great amount of detail in the projects that coming to these or listening to them is by no means a prerequisite for success, but some students do tend to find these sections helpful for just getting started and working through problems. So what I can do, among other things, is do a more detailed walkthrough of some of the code, certainly the salient source files that are relelevant to tonight's class. There's essentially three aspects to Project 1. One is an implementation of some SAC stuff, one is some implementation of some DOM stuff, and two is some use of Xerces, the industry standard parser. So the middle of those, DOM, will defer till next week, since we don't have the conceptual underpinnings yet, but we can certainly look at the other code. But first, are there questions, concerns? Are there confusing things the guy in the other room said a few minutes ago? An excellent question. So, in fact, let me be as specific as to turn the pages of Project 1 spec and perhaps just number by number say, get started on this one, wait on this one. That might be the best way to get started. So I'm on the Project 1 specification. If you don't have one, they're right here in the middle. Looking on page 2 with number 1, 2, 3, and 4, those should probably have been done already if you took my helpful little email advice. But if not, you're certainly not behind. But one of the most important things to get accomplished immediately is this attainment of an FAS account. Inevitably, some students have trouble with this only because their ID number isn't on file with FAS or some stupid reasons like that that just end up making you nervous and costing you time. So do get a jump start on that. If you essentially getting an FAS account requires that you type in your ID, among other things. Often, the extension school has multiple ID numbers, so far as I can tell. So if you have any questions as to what your ID is, just email me, and I'll tell you what your ID is. Independent of your FAS account, though, you can still do all of the work for the project and every other project on your local PC, Mac, Linux box, Solaris box, whatever. But to submit the work, you will need this FAS account. So do get that right away. Number 5 is just some helpful advice. If you have never used version control of any sort or backups even, allow me to propose that you use them certainly around deadline time. Since as in the syllabus, while we are willing to consider extensions and whatnot in the event of emergencies, we rather define emergencies as death and illness and not your computer crashed and so forth. So 3 weeks for each project we do feel... We don't, no. So, because a lot of students end up developing on their own machines anyway, so we simply suggest that you use whatever's your favorite. So, with that said, number 6 is quite doable now. Number 7 is not doable yet, at least so far as lectures go. You can certainly tackle all of this tonight if you wish. Number 8, I would wait. Number 9 is half doable. Essentially everything up to the DOM part. Number 10 is doable. Number 11 is doable. And we'll double back to the details in these juicy questions. Number 12 and 13 and 14 are doable. 15 you can wait on. 16 you can wait on. 17 you can do, 18 you can do, 19 you should do, and then the rest, 20 and 21 you could do, should do, 22 you can also do, and finally 23 you can do. A lot of questions in this project. And 24 you can do. So essentially, the means by which I just parsed this document was I looked for mentions of DOM, and I essentially said wait on anything that mentioned DOM. So you two can use the same heuristic. So you have most of the background now, certainly, to tackle almost all of the project. So never fear. And I would repeat my advice from last week. The projects are meant to be done over the course of 3 weeks, you know, maybe 2 weeks, not in one weekend. And they're certainly doable in a weekend, but I don't think it would be a fun weekend. And it certainly is not the ideal way to develop software under pressure when the point of the class probably is to get something intellectual out of it, something practical out of it, not just to hit deadlines for the sake of hitting deadlines. So I would honestly aspire generally in the semester, bite off a third of the project each week. And that might take a night, might take a couple days, nights, but pace yourself. So other general questions. I'll promise you a code walkthrough because that's probably quite useful, but other things you might want to get out of the way.
Quick question about one of the slides, too.
Okay.
The entities, the last point, maybe I missed this in lecture, but they cannot refer to themselves.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
I just mean that you can't map percent NBSP semicolon, or rather ampersand NBSP semicolon to quote-unquote ampersand NBSP semicolon. So quite literally that. Other questions? Concerns? It's okay. If I said something confusing or poorly or incorrectly, now's your chance to correct it. Okay, well, should we take a closer look at some of the code? And have these been... Oh, come now. We'll start them on the other end. See if they... There we go. All right. So, and I promised you I'd be down at your level, and hopefully this isn't too casual since this room is not conducive to working from a computer. So what I'm going to do is walk us through at least five files, pretty much in the order in which I think it's easiest to grasp what they're doing and what their relevance is. So let me move this a little out of our way. And for those of you tuning in through this microphone, I will do my best to cite line numbers in particular as we walk through so that it's as useful remotely. So the first file, again, let's take a quick glance at tester.java, which you should have in your packet. All the files are alphabetically listed, so you can find them quickly. And again, I'm going to just scroll down to the main routine because I kind of... This is just the project 1.6.0/build.xml packet that has all the source code from the course. And incidentally, let me take one quick step back and just point out that on the course's website already, as always, is even though the project spec itself walks you through the process of copying these files via CP and so forth via your Unix account, you can certainly, as an alternative, simply download a zip or tarball of the same exact code off of the website. So in short, you're pretty much 100% independent of the FAS system, except for submissions, which we do require go through that system for uniformity and timestamping and so forth. But everything is available here. You don't need to even be that Unix savvy. Printable code, too. I essentially generate automatically packets like this. If you don't pick it up in class, you can print it out yourself. Not necessary, but sometimes useful to mark it up and so forth. Okay. With that said, and please interrupt me at any point with questions, the tester program. This in and of itself is only meant to help you test your code. And you can certainly test your code in other ways, but this is meant to test it on an overall basis. Is everything working together? The idea being that you would use tester.java once you compile it, running it on each of the XML files that we've provided, 1.xml through 8.xml, but hopefully, and as I suggest in the spec itself, try your other files, because they are certainly not exhaustive in the types of cases that you must handle, but it's certainly not hard with your own Notepad or Pico text editor to whip up your own XML files that are representative of other cases. And how do you figure out those cases? Well, just read the grammar and mock something up that's consistent with the spec and make sure that your parser handles it. So there's only two test cases, and they're explained in the specification, but case one, which you specified the command line, as I showed earlier, essentially allows you to test your SAX parsing and serializer. Because, again, one of the key missing aspects of the code base is that it doesn't support attributes. So once you take a first pass at the code and implement support for attributes, you'll not only have to modify the parser to support attributes, but the serializer to then print those attributes. And we'll look at those files in more detail in just a moment, but that's the spirit of what this test case tests. Test 2 tests your DOM builder. So more on that next week, but it essentially tests the code you write that constructs an in-memory tree of your code. And that's about all. Again, I try to be profuse with the comments so that these things are pretty self-explanatory. But let's draw our attention to contenthandler.java. So embodied in Project One's code base is essentially a simplification of the JAXP API itself. The idea is to introduce you to the concepts underlying JAXP, but without diving headfirst into the more relatively more complicated JAXP code, and with it many more methods than you'll even need or have occasion to use. So what you'll notice, hopefully, at the top of pretty much every one of the Java files in Project 1 is I've mentioned in the first sentence what it is a simplification of, so that in working through this code, you'll hopefully later, in the latter part of the project, when you use Xerces, be able to relate the code you wrote and worked with the actual industry standard implementation. And I've tried to name things the same way. I've tried to use usually the same parameterization, but the implementations are much simpler, and they're exposed for you to see. So what is a content handler? Well, we looked briefly at the Java doc for the JAXP content handler interface. This is E259's simplified version of that content handler. Same spirit, simpler implementation. So notice, and for those of you unfamiliar or less savvy with Java and so forth, we've defined this as an interface. And as an aside, let me mention too that sections are absolutely the venue for asking silly questions, dumb questions like what's HTML or what is Java doc or any of the basics that we might be assuming. So please interrupt or ask discreetly after if you prefer. So a content handler, and there's more comments here than code, is simply an interface, an API, if you will, that requires that anyone implementing this interface implement that method, characters, end document, end element, start document, and so forth. So an interface, for those unfamiliar, simply specifies the return values, the names of methods, and the parameterization of methods that must be implemented if your class is to implement this interface. Absolutely. This is almost exactly like a header file in C, or really it's more like a class definition in C++ where you don't inline the implementations of those functions.
For example, this interface here is defined in SACS.
A like-named interface called Content Handler is defined in SACS, but notice that this class is in the Computer Science E259 package, so it's our own little microcosm, your own SACS. The MF package is all about implementing your first parser that reflects the JAXP, the SACS, the DOM one, but it's simpler so that we can play with relatively simpler code. It's not fun to.
We don't need any of those packages. We don't need
not in this. Not until you get to question 22. My second XML parser is Xerces. So again, chunk one of the project is to write your own parser or parts thereof. Part two is to use an off-the-shelf parser. Projects 3 and 4, use that off-the-shelf parser some more, among other things. So this is the interface. And again, it's meant to reflect the JAXP one, but again, it's a little simpler. And in fact, let me take a quick step back and just note that also useful in teaching yourself this code is if you run ant java doc, and I'll come back to ant in just a moment, what this will do is generate java doc for all the E259 code in your own directory, and the spec talks about how you can put that in your public HTML directory so you can access it on the web and in a password protected directory. We've automated a lot of that, but what you can also do for now, since we distributed this base code in the website, you can just go to the Java doc. So in fact, we can look at the same code through the Java doc interface, and here is, again, our content handler interface now demonstrated to you through Java doc instead of VI, which I was pulling it up with before. But same.
Because you did the ant thing, just a minute ago?
No, this is hosted on the website and will stay on the website and is the Java doc for the distribution version of the code. What we show you in the spec is that if you want to generate Java doc for your own modified code, then you can do that as well. But this is the default course library. It's always here, but becomes increasingly less relevant the more you change your code. This JavaDoc automatically italicizes interfaces and leaves classes not italicized. Good question. And again, here too, if you've never seen JavaDoc before, make some confused look or catch my attention. But all it is a HTML-based documentation for Java code. And it ships with Java, or you can access it on the web. For instance, earlier tonight, one of the most useful resources in the course I suggested you start to make use of is the JAXP API. Looks the same in structure, but this is all of the comments essentially in Sun Microsystems implementation of all these classes, but you too can generate this as the spec teaches you. And it's just a useful way. I think this is actually one of the huge selling points of Java is just the documentation and the ease with which you can generate it, frankly. It makes it so much easier to learn stuff like what we do in this course, just because HTML exists. So, with that said, let's take a moment, let's pause for a moment in looking at default handler, which recall is the implementation of that interface, and just look at build.xml. How many of you have not used ANT before? Okay, so most hands have gone up. So ANT is just a little command line utility that automates the process of building code so that never in this class will you actually have to execute Java C. Unless you want to compile the lecture examples, which are so simple you might as well just execute Java C. You don't need an infrastructure for them. ANT works as follows. It uses, not surprisingly, an XML file for its configuration file. So precisely in the spirit in which I was discussing a mail program earlier tonight. All of this is comments up top, sort of self-explanatory, but what it's essentially teaching you is what you can type in order to make use of this configuration file. Notice that it's saying, if you want to compile the code explored in questions 11 through 21, you can type this in the current directory. And that just automates the process of building the relevant files to those questions. Why does it do that? Well, down below, I've specified what should be built by typing this command. If you simply type ANT by itself, as I did earlier, or equivalently, ANT compile, it tries to compile all of the Java source code in your directory. So if you've never used ANT before but have only taken E50A, B, I mean, consider the utility of a program that saves you the trouble of typing this 22 times for the 22 files that happen to be in your current directory. I mean, that's its utility. There's nothing fundamentally wonderful about it beyond utility. Oh, come on in. So just to give you a glimpse at this, and build files are something I'll always distribute with the project, so if you never look at them, you probably will be just fine. You never need to configure them yourself. But for those of you who want to, you know, learn a new technology, learn a new piece of software, look at stuff like this and look at the ANT manual, which is linked on the course's website under software, because you too can automate yet more processes, especially if you start implementing your own classes or your own test programs. You can automate a lot of that with ANT. But for our purposes, this is just meant to save you time. And you're given enough to get the job done. It also automates the process, for instance, of compiling your Java doc. That's why I was able to type ANT Java doc, and just all the commands that are necessary for that happen automatically. There's another command that we've implemented called not just Java doc, but ANT Java doc publish, which, per the spec, automates the process of installing the Java doc in your public HTML directory so that if you're developing on FAS, you can actually look at your own Java doc in a password-protected directory on your homepage. It's just a little utility function. If you never use it, you won't be any worse off, but it's there for you. So, John.
Just related to public HTML, which you were saying, in Unix, mm-hmm. You create that directory, and if you put your HTML files in there, then automatically, where they just get displayed. But what about on Windows,
what web server would... Oh, so if you are just doing this on Windows, if you run ANT Java doc, according to the spec, you will get a directory on your current machine, on your local machine, that looks like... So if you download Project 1 from the website, you'll get a directory like this. Out of the box, we've given you a docs directory with the Java doc pre-built. So if you want to view your Java doc on Windows, it actually suffices just to double-click index.html, and it will just open in your browser, Netscape, IE, whatever. You don't need a web server, public HTML, none of that. Just double-click it.
Mm-hmm. We can put it anywhere we want on C drive or D drive.
Yep, absolutely.
And then run
ant and then what? Yep, I mean, the project spec, usually in the form of footnotes, tells you if you want to do something locally, what you need to download, what environment variables you might need to set, and sometimes where you need to put the code. But you can do it. And many students have done it before. Frankly, when I write the code, I do it on my own machine. I tend not to use NICE all the time. So, yes. And one of the best uses of the listserv, honestly, because if someone's having trouble with their Mac OS machine, their Windows machine, is the listserv. Just to say, hey, here's the problem I'm having. I can probably answer all of these questions, too. But with so many students in the class, usually someone else is online and can even answer you more quickly. So use the listserv absolutely for stuff like that. Because inevitably we'll get questions on the listserv. I mean, I'll put money on this one, you know, about setting your environment variable, setting your class path, all these annoying little details that are not very easily done as they should be on Windows or even Unix sometimes, but are surmountable, always. Okay. Any questions on ant or the two files we've glanced at? Okay, so let's dive into some of the juicier stuff, the next of which is default handler. So default handler does what? Tell me something interesting about it. Yeah, right, so that, and I heard something even simpler, nothing. So it does nothing. And that's true, right? What is it? How is it defined? By all means. So default handler is a class that implements content handler. Just to be redundant, what was content handler? Just an interface. So here's our actual implementations. And notice, as we said in lecture, just as JaxP provides you with a class called default handler that does nothing, so does our implementation of default handler do nothing. You might as well keep them there. They're the most popular for you. So how do we achieve nothing? Open bracket, close bracket. That's all. And again, why is this useful to have this lying around? So why is it useful? So in this case, but generally speaking, let's go back quickly to tonight's lecture example. Sorry? And why is it better, why is it sometimes more useful to extend rather than implement an interface?
Right. Code for every single method.
Right. You don't have to. Go ahead.
But then why would you. Right, exactly. So I was wondering why then. So you have this thing, so you have an interface called content.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have default handler, which extends content handler. So
implements content handler.
Yeah, so that implements content handler because content handler isn't an object.
Mm-hmm.
So why do it that way? Why don't you have a class called content handler and then have default handler extend that? Why do you have it as a why do you have an interface?
Okay, good question. So, in short, for the microphone here, why this extra layer of the interface? And it's for precisely that reason, so that you do have this additional layer, so that you can standardize what methods must be implemented if you were to parse a document. So, for instance, if you wanted to specify that the parse routine has to be handed a set of it has to be handed an object that implements a set of methods. The only way to do that in Java is to say that it takes an object that implements a certain interface. You can't say that it takes a foo object because then... Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Let me retract some of that. It's cleaner in Java to say that a method must take an object that implements an interface than to say it must take an object of a certain type or a subclass thereof. Simply because the purpose of an interface is to remove entirely the aspect of implementation so that you can have objects, classes, that implement multiple interfaces so that they don't have to extend directly from just one class. Having this extra layer of interfaces just gives you more flexibility. And it might seem like a little more work, but in the end, it allows you to achieve a cleaner design. And we won't see that much in this class, because usually we'll just implement one interface. Sometimes you'll see us implementing two, but that is one of the most compelling reasons to do so. Yeah, that's good too. Yeah, no, I like that. Like, it's a conceptual difference too. An interface, like you said earlier, is like a header file. It's a laundry list of things you must implement, not necessarily that you have implemented. And it's a cleaner design, ultimately. And I think, dare say, not at the risk of punting, dare say that will become more clear the more you dabble with it and the more you realize, oh, that was a good design decision.
I mean, I assume that there's administrative overhead as a programmer that you would have if you've got a lot more classes.
That too.
This is sort of my faith that you use interfaces because it saves, sort of makes you more productive if you have a larger set of classes than you're trying to.
Right.
Like, sort of like, take out the. Figure out which method you want to play with.
Yeah.
It allows you to sort of discipline you.
Yes. And you could achieve a similar effect with like an abstract class in Java, but the problem there too is that now when you have descendants, you start to get into issues of hierarchy and you have things descending from other classes even though conceptually you might not want them to. You don't want to impose this hierarchy and it wouldn't make sense to put one below the other just because you want to have him have this functionality and this functionality. It just gets messy very quickly is the short of it. But a good question. And so default handler, just to sum up, does nothing. But it's useful because notice what I could have done in, for instance, tonight's lecture example. In my examples 2 directory with saxdemo.java, I did implement, I think, all of the methods. But suppose the only one the class cared to see tonight, because they were so fed up with all the other examples, you know what, let's just look at start elements and let's go home. Well, this code too would have compiled and would have run. And the saxdemo would have run, but it only would have handled with interesting results this method, start element. And that's the utility. It's just quicker runtime, quicker start to finish, because you have those null implementations to fall back on. So, looking back at the source code, I think it makes sense next to look at XML parser itself, since that's the guts of where, that's where you'll be spending most of your time for the first aspect of the project. And I say most of your time, realize that with this project, there is a lot of code, and that's intentional, especially to raise the bar for students who have not had as much Java background, really to hit the ground running and get you more used to closer to real-world development projects. Since in the real world, unlike E50A and B, you're not writing a single Java file called, you know, tic-tac-toe.java, right? Projects become more interesting and more complicated, and so that's the spirit of this. What you will find is that you've been given much more code than you need to write yourself. In fact, your contributions to the project, though these 16 pages might imply otherwise, are relatively few. For instance, implementation of attribute support can probably be done with like a dozen lines of code total. So the important aspect, the takeaway hopefully, is the thought process and understanding how it fits in and how to handle the grammar correctly, not in writing lines and lines and lines of code. The code itself is pretty simple. So with that said, again, this is XML parser. This is really the playground in which you'll be playing with attribute support, ultimately. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, they're all alphabetical, though. So this starts on... Oh, I see. I can't really tell you what page they're on because there are no page numbers on the packet. So just alphabetically, it's toward the end of the packet. It's the second to last file, xmlparser.java. Every page is page 1 or 2 in this handout. So, Nscript. It allows you to just iterate over multiple files and concatenate them all together. Okay, so the first three things to notice is that, one, this class has a string in which we are somewhat inefficiently but quite easily going to be storing the entirety of the XML file in the form of a string. It just removes some complexity for us on day one. We have a reference to a content handler. That is so that throughout our parsing, we know whose implementations of the SAX interface to trigger. We need to remember who we were told to pass the events back to. And the index is just a global variable or a class variable that allows us to remember, rather an instance variable that allows us to remember where in that long string of XML we currently are whilst parsing. Okay?
Are the underscores relevant?
This is a convention only to indicate that they are instance variables as opposed to local variables in the classes, just to help you remember where it came from. What languages do you have a background in? What language or languages have you had experience with?
I have Java experience.
Okay.
I'm more basically database.
It's doable if you don't have much of a Java background, but I would have to caution that you'll spend more than the time than the typical student because you'll be learning Java in lockstep with the material. And that might be enough of a hindrance to some students that it would be more of an aggravation than it's worth. But what I think you'll get with Project 1 and before the drop or withdrawal deadline is enough of a sense of the type of the extent to which we'll be using Java. Realize that Project 1 is very Java intensive. Project 2 will use no Java. It will be all XSLT and some other stuff. Projects 3 and 4, though, will return us to Java, but in a server context. So it's really up to you how many learning curves you want to tackle at once. So, okay. So, the most interesting method to start with is perhaps the first, which is parse, because remember, that's really the entry point to this class, XML Parser. What class was it that called this parse method? Just to get everything integrated here mentally. Well, we're in XML Parser. Not default handler. Oh, I think I heard it. Tester. In the case one aspect of tester was an instantiation of an XML parser object, and then we called that reference dot parse. And we passed to it the name of the file, recall, and we passed a reference to a content handler. Okay, so that's where we came from. And again, if you walk out, if you're still not, couldn't repeat everything we just said, that's fine. You just saw the code probably for the first time, but hopefully you'll remember some of these visual cues. So here's the parse routine. A lot of it looks kind of scary, but this is just Java syntax to actually sucking the contents out of a file and filling a string with them. Not really something terribly relevant to you. All you can trust is that by the end of this line here, which is, let me try to work from this document so I can relate it to the folks tuning in from home. This is, I can cheat. What am I doing? This is on line 91 of XML parser. That's the call that ultimately puts all the XML file's contents into that string object for you. The string object being called data underscore. So these last three lines of XML parser, which are lines 101 through 103, are where you sort of on a leap of faith again, call start document, then you read an element, then you call end document. And herein lies the launch of our recursion with this call here. Presumably, this induces some recursion. So let's quickly take a look at start document, then end document, because you'll find them to be terribly uninteresting, and then look at the juicy stuff, read elements. So start document, we're in the same file here on out. Oh, sorry. We are, for the moment, in... Let me show you for a second. You don't have to turn to this page, but recall that in tester, we did call this parse routine, and the reference we passed it was a content handler, but specifically it was an XML serializer. Okay, so this line in test case 1 instantiates an XML serializer, and then it uses that as the content handler. So that begs the question, what is an XML serializer? For now, I think it suffices for me just to say that it is a class that implements the content handler interface by necessity. What does it do? Conceptually, it takes SAX events and spits them out as literal XML content. Generally speaking, an XML serializer takes XML and spits it out as XML. This is why I said earlier, the net result of your testing is zero, right? You take XML input, you better produce XML output. This class XML serializer spits out XML. How does it do that? Well, if we look quickly at xmlserializer.java, there's a bunch of methods in here, none of which you really need to spend much time on, but the interesting one, for instance, might be start element. And ultimately, you will have to modify this code to support the printing of attributes, but just to give you a sense tonight of what it does, this start element is clearly a SACS event handler, right? It's start element. Well, what is it defined to do? Well, it's defined in spirit to serialize XML, or rather to serialize SACS events. Well, what does that mean? That just means when you get a start element call, print it out literally. Write out the angle bracket, write out the name of the element, write out a close bracket. So literally serialize that start element back out, just so that we have an aesthetic result. Notice the to-do here. Eventually, you're going to use the attributes that were passed in as an attributes object, or a reference there too, and you're actually going to iterate over those attributes, presumably, and then print each of those out with some system.out calls or some write calls or whatever. That, though, will be contingent on how you implement attributes in XML parser. And so that's where we should return our attention to. John? Sure.
You talk about the routine here before we went this way. What was the name of this object?
XML parser? Tester, content handler, default handler?
No, serializer.
Serializer.
Serializer, which you said implements, you said that that implements content handler.
Correct. In effect, by extending default handler, which in turn
All right, that's what confused me, because you were talking about implements content handler, and I'm like, well, why do we even do default handler? Why didn't we just do XML serializer implements content handler?
So again, the reason is that in the real SACS API, as we'll see with the latter part of the project, there is many more methods than just start document, start element, end element. There's several others, like the start prefix mapping and so forth. And you don't want to get into the habit of trying to implement all of those methods because often they're not useful to you.
So the default handler implements content.
Correct.
Content handler is just an interface.
Right.
Perfect.
Okay. So then this extends that. So this adds methods to default handler.
This overrides methods that were implemented in default handler. Good. Good.
And all of the methods were implemented in default handler?
As open bracket, close bracket.
Right.
Yep. Perfect. Okay, so pop all of those conversations off your mental stacks, and we're back in XML parser.java. So with that said, remember that the line we were on was start document. Well, what handler start document routine is being called? Well, again, what kind of object is our handler? Tester called parse. It was an XML serializer that tester handed to the SACS parser to say, hey, use this guy in order to execute your callbacks. So we look then at XML serializer, as we just did. Start document is the method in question, and unfortunately, pattern not found. So what does that mean? When this line of code is called, what happens? Nothing, but why? Good. I didn't implement start document in XML serializer.java, but I need to, because I was extending default handler, and he did implement it with that null implementation. So the effect net is like a no-op. But methods are called, and they are implemented. It's just I chose not to override them. After all, the goal of this part of the project is, again, take XML input, produce the same XML output. What does it mean to say start document? Well, it's not like you have to say anything. It's not like you have to do anything. The first time you'll need to say something is when what kind of event is called? Start element. Right? The first thing to happen in the simplified XML world is when you encounter your root element. So that's why I just left it null. And so therein already lies some of the utility of default handler. Saves me the trouble of doing that myself. It's reusable. So the juicy stuff And the real parser and the recognizer begins with this call, this leap of faith. Sure.
So if you were to create different types of parsers, you would just basically, as you said, the juicy stuff is just a read element.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to do different things with read element, you would just basically, copy this code, XML serializer.
Okay.
And change the read element for
Careful. So we are currently, the cursor is blinking on XML parser.java.
Right.
The parser is designed to be a SAX parser insofar as the parser is defined to execute the SAX events, handlers, upon encountering interesting events. So this is fundamentally independent and irrelevant to XML serializer. It just so happens, though, that whereas XML parser calls SAX events, XML serializer implements those SAX event handlers. So the serializer, the parser calls the serializer. So changing read element really shouldn't affect the serializer.
Right.
So in effect, XML parser is communicating in a sense with XML serializer, but only through the content handler interface. That's the means by which they interact. And this again is the beauty in general of APIs and interfaces, in that you could, if you decide after this class that you really liked your parser but it was horrible for performance, you could go back and re-architect read element. But your end results are still to behave in the same fundamental way. You might just be much quicker at it. So again, using these interfaces and so forth allow Apache, for instance, to completely overhaul their implementation of a parser while still implementing the same spec, the same API. So let's take a look at read element in XML parser.java. This, as the comment says, parses an element and its content. And it is relatively simple, because we make a number of simplifying assumptions in the project to keep our eye on the ball, so to speak. And the first thing readElement does is what? Looks for a start tag. And as I recall, John, that was essentially your suggestion tonight. So what just inferring from this method's definition, the name, is start tag, what do you think that method does? All right, let's take a look. Returns true if it's a left bracket. So this call looks like it returns a bool or boolean. Well, on line 64 of XML parser.java, we have a one-liner, essentially, that says if the character at the current index location is an open left bracket, then return true. But this is Java syntax for saying all that in one line. Else it returns false. Okay? So if that is true, let's go back to where we were, which was in our parse routine. So if that, we were in our read element routine. And that's right here. So if it is a start tag, we clearly don't throw this exception, we proceed. And what do? Well, we read the start tag. Right? Conceptually, what does it probably mean to read a start tag? An array, but even higher level than that. What does it mean to read a start tag? I'm sorry? Maybe make a new object? Even literally, you've got this string of XML data, and I've just called read start tag. Quite literally, what does it need to do? Read it character by character. So start with the open bracket, read it char by char by char until you encounter the close bracket, and probably retain... You can throw away the brackets because they're tokens that are conceptually interesting but no longer relevant. And so let's take a look at read start tag, which is on line 185 of the same file, XML parser.java. And notice what we do. Well, we increment our index +++ just because that effectively skips us over the angled bracket that we know is there because of our prior Boolean call. Then we execute this while. While the character at the current index is not equal to the close bracket, the token, if you will, go ahead and append to this local variable called name that current character. then increment your index.
Isn't this the method where we would look for illegal characters?
Yes. Typically, you would look in this method for illegal characters like punctuation marks and so forth. Currently, though, it just does this. Very simple syntax.
Do we have to do that? Should we be concerned with looking for illegal characters?
You only need to do what the specs problem specifically say. So as I recall, we do not ask that you go back and fix our code. So even though this won't read special characters, if the specs if the challenge in the problem is not go back, it doesn't say literally go back and support this shortcoming, you don't have to do it. Okay? We do, and again, this isn't so much laziness as it is simplification. We don't include a lot of these checks because it clouds, I think, the underlying concepts. But if they're ever in question, just email me. But otherwise, unless you're told, you don't have to go back and fix shortcomings in our code because they were probably intentional. Or they're bugs, in which case you can point them out. Okay, what do you do next? Plus plus, because you read implicitly that closed angled bracket. What do you want to return? Well, wait a minute. You don't want to return yet. Because what is this parser supposed to do insofar as he's supposed to be a SAX parser? He's got to fire off the start element event. And because we've just read the name of the element in line 206 of xmlparser.java, we now know enough in order to call this event handler. Notice, though, we're passing in null. What does the null there imply?
No attributes.
Support doesn't yet exist. So clearly, one of the places in which you'll be dabbling for this project probably is in this method somewhere, you know, probably around here where it says do this, right? Now specifically, what does that mean? Well, up here, you know, probably need some changes up here, because up here we read the name, but rather you're probably not going to be iterating pursuant to this project in line 194 for an open angled bracket only. You also want to do something interesting if you encounter what?
A space.
Because a space either implies just meaningless white space, in which case you can keep churning away, but the spec does not allow for such, so it probably means that you have an attribute, equal sign, quoted value. And so part of your contribution in this part of the project will be parse those attributes. And there might be zero, there might be n of them. It's up to you to handle an arbitrary number to then store them in this attributes object, which we can glance at if need be, but pretty straightforward. And then pass an actual reference to the event handler. And briefly, an attributes object, let's actually look at that through Java doc. An attributes object, plural, is an object that has add attribute as a method, get length, get name, and get value. So it's kind of like a hash table of some sort. If we look at the code for attributes.java, unfortunately, there's some items to do. So I say it's in spirit like a hash table. It could also be considered a linked list. It could be an array. How you implement it is up to you. But if your Java experience is such that you're not familiar with any of the terms I just enumerated, array, hash table, linked list, whatever, realize that that's the extent to which we do expect students to be familiar with Java. You should know how you might approach this, but if you've not experimented with the most efficient hash maps or hash tables before, an array is fine for the course. But if you don't know what an array is, that's where the line of comfort begins to be drawn.
And we can assume that when we do have attributes, that they will be object forms, so that we don't have to implement error checking in these.
I will defer to the spec. So what the spec says is what you should do. But if the spec, again, is not focusing on some aspect of the parser, not a problem. You can certainly go back and fix it, but there's enough, I think, independent of that. For what just note, there's also another class we include in the project called attr.java. Though you might be inclined to use attr.java for the SAX part of the project, specifically the most obvious approach to implementing the attributes object might be to use something like a hash table, or more simply, to use a linked list and store in that linked list an object of type attribute, singular, where an attribute has two fields, name and value. You can do this in a whole bunch of ways. You might be inclined to use the attr object, because if you look at it closely, you'll see it's just that. It has associated with it a name and a value, and it's like an attribute in the singular sense. However, I would advise against that only because @her is intentionally included because it's a simplification of the DOM API. The DOM API uses @her objects. The SACS API uses attributes objects, but only as this passing mechanism for the SACS events. So whereas you could use @her objects and store them in attributes objects, that would be to violate the spirit of the independence of the SACS and DOM APIs. So I would not do so.
So we should make
our own attribute object? Your own attribute object, or implement the attributes class with a Java hash table or something like that. Whatever you want to do to get the job done. But this is just to make clear the spirit of the independence of the APIs. You wouldn't be wrong to do it, but again, we're trying not to conflate the two, lest you be confused after the course. Okay, so read start tag. Now we're done. We've read the start element in line 206, or rather we've read it in this method, and now we're calling the event handler and said, here you go, I packaged up all the salient information, the name of the thing, and the attributes ultimately. Do with it whatever you're supposed to do. Okay, where did we end up then? Well, back in our beginning, we had read elements. And so where were we in that element? Well, again, mentally, you have to go back on your stack. What did we just do? We read a start tag. Well, what do we now do? It's in this method, read element, that you see the recursive descent parsing taking place. Notice that essentially, I want this method to keep reading elements until I read an end tag. Right? Because if it's an end tag, hopefully it's the one associated with this one. And so my read end tag name, suppose for simplicity the file we're parsing is 1.xml, which is open bracket foo, close bracket, close foo. Okay? This loop would then never really execute, because after reading start tag, we would immediately have encountered a close tag. What do you think lets you know that you're about to read an end tag as opposed to a start tag? Two characters. All right, so a look ahead buffer of two. Open bracket, forward slash. And in fact, let's take a quick look just to convince you that's true. How does it work? It does exactly that. So going back to read element, or read element. So in that simple case of 1.xml, the next thing we want to do is read end tag. Well, what do you do in that method? Well, read end tag, which appears on line 147. It seems to do a lot, but really all it's doing is the same thing as read start tag. It's even simpler because you don't need to deal with attributes in end tags, because recall, you only end the name, you don't end the attributes. And the only thing that it does of interest is it has to confirm now that the name in the end tag matches the name in the start tag, because otherwise you've got an error of validity, or error of well-formedness, rather, which just means the document's not properly balanced. But let's jump back mentally. Suppose the document's a little more interesting than 1.xml, and you've got some character content, or you have some element content. Coming back to our element our discussion tonight, well, if you've got a start tag coming up at you, then you've got more element content. Recurse. Read another element. If, though, you don't have another element, read text. You've got PC data. PC data, I'll defer these to an at-home exercise. It just reads the character data up until what point? When do you stop reading character data? You find that less than sign. Right? Because character data can only be betwixt an open tag and a start tag. So the moment you see an open bracket, you've either encountered another start tag or a close tag. And so you can return and let this guy deal with whatever has been encountered. So again, and I keep saying simplification because often it's not sufficient with real XML documents just to assume that an open bracket means, oh, you're done. But for the XML model we present in the spec, it does work. And I think it allows you to really walk through the process of what it means to parse, and hopefully, among other things, gives you appreciation not only for how the APIs work in a simpler sandbox, but also start to reveal to you where the performance bottlenecks can really be, and why XML is or is not the best mechanism for, you know, modeling your data.
Why is the attribute converter class in a higher level of attribute?
Only because, so that is part of the project too, attribute converter doesn't need to use necessarily. So the MF package is all about parsing, and arguably we could have put the tester elsewhere, but attribute converter is just an application, and that it uses my first parser is sort of irrelevant. In fact, it doesn't. It uses Xerces, so it doesn't belong in the MF package, which is only the E259 simplification. So just to recap, if you want to walk yourself through this code again, or if you're tuning in via this podcast, I think the five most useful files to begin looking through, as we just did tonight, is one, the tester.java, two, contenthandler.java, three, defaulthandler.java, four, xmlparser.java, and that's the juiciest one, really, five, attributes.java, and then, as we interwove things tonight, XML serializer.java, some of the other stuff. But when I was looking through the code earlier, these five files, in that order, I think, are the best jump start to the code, to getting your hands dirty with it. So with that said, are there any questions or nervousness about where to start? Where did we use that? Iterator. Oh, that should not be there. You can use that. It is usually used for iterating over the objects in the linked list or any object that provides you with some kind of linked structure. I say it shouldn't be there only because you don't need to use it. So I'll go in and delete that ultimately. It's not all that much of a clue. It's more useful for me to have said use a hash table or use a linked list than to say use an iterator. Okay. Well, in sum, JavaDoc is your friend. Playing around with the source code is your friend. And just following the directions in the spec will get you quite on your way.